In about half of states in this country, employers used to be able to fire people for being gay or transgender. That changed Monday. The highest court in the U.S. has ruled that a law banning discrimination based on sex includes people who are in the LGBTQ plus communities. We're talking about what that means for public policy. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What is your response to the Supreme Court's ruling? What broader implications do you anticipate the opinion having? Are you LGBT? What's it like for you to navigate this time? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Isaac West. He's an associate professor of communication at Vanderbilt University and the author of Transforming Citizenships, Transgender Articulations of the Law. Isaac, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation to talk about this important case today.
This decision makes employment discrimination due to a person's sexual orientation or gender identity illegal. What does that mean for people who face discrimination at work for those reasons?
I think this decision is significant for a couple different reasons. The first thing is that it's the first explicit victory for trans folk in the Supreme Court. And somewhat surprisingly, Gorsuch addressed trans issues in an affirming manner. And here, you know, we kind of have to wonder how much his colleagues and the clerks influenced the tone of his decision, not so much because of him, but just because of past court decisions that have often not been respectful in that way. And although the dissenters in this case lamented the majority's refusal to define the term sexual orientation and gender identity, I think the flexibility provided by the lack of the definition is an unusual but also a pretty welcome development. And so I think that of the things that will come of this case, it will hopefully help to deter future acts of discrimination as people learn more about this case and its implications.
So how is this ruling different from how the law used to help us understand sex discrimination?
Well, as you stated in the intro, you know, a lot of people were unaware that it was legal and, in fact, you know, sanctioned that it was OK to fire people because they were gay, identified as trans, and for other categories. So I think one of the important outcomes of this is it really does make a strong statement to employers and to the public who might not have been aware of the lack of employment protections. My students often didn't know about it. When I've given other public talks, people are often surprised. And so hopefully it will start to rectify the uneven distribution of precarity and vulnerability that are directed at trans and queer folk, especially trans and queer folk of color, who experience the highest rates of employment discrimination. And so the way that this decision ultimately says that, you know, it is no longer okay to fire people or to not hire them or to promote them because of their sexual orientation or because of their gender identity is a pretty significant shift from before.
We're talking with Isaac West, who studies legal rhetoric and how gender and sexuality relate to our understanding of citizenship. And he's with us to discuss the legal implications of Monday's Supreme Court ruling on sex discrimination. And we are taking your calls, your questions, your responses at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or give us a call, 800-642-1234. Isaac, how might we see this particular ruling extend to other areas beyond employment, or even will we?
Yeah, that is very much an open question. You know, one thing, it's the decisions are very easy to read, relatively speaking, for a Supreme Court decision. And so I really urge people to read them. They're written to be read by a lay public who may not understand all the ins and outs of, you know, arcane bits of law. Now, the dissents really belabor the floodgates that might have been opened by the decision. And there may be some cascading effects as it relates, for example, to the really odious anti-trans bathroom laws. I think courts will be pretty hard-pressed to find evidence to substantiate the unfounded fears underwriting these laws, especially given the way that the decision takes up the question of sex and how we might define it. And Gorsuch, I mean, he punted on these issues in that particular decision because they were not before the court, and that was the right thing to do. But I would imagine that insurance companies are going to have to rethink their policies regarding trans medical care. I'm not sure how they can justify excluding it from their coverage after the decision. The one thing that people seem concerned about relative to this decision is whether or not it will affect religious organizations of different kinds. And I have to imagine that this court in particular would go out of its way to create carve-outs for religious organizations. I don't know so much about corporations, but I do think they'll protect churches, for example.
Interesting. Yeah, because some employers, they bring their religious beliefs to their work. Do we know if businesses are able to disregard this ruling based on religious freedom laws?
Well, we're going to get an answer to that maybe even today. Who knows? Because the Sisters of the Poor case and so on, because they're about to rule on some religious freedom cases. And so, you know, there's been some kind of reading of the tea leaves relative to the Bostock decision here that we're talking about to the other cases that deal with religious freedom and whether or not Alito's pretty fiery dissent may, you know, that it's definitely about the case that we're talking about today, but it could also maybe be about some other things. So I'm not sure exactly how they'll parse those different parts out, but it seems like they're going to have to find a way to do that.
We've got a comment, Jack from Caledonia called 800-642-1234. Jack thinks no one should be fired for anything other than work performance, but also doesn't think the Supreme Court needed to make such a drastic new designation of what sex or gender are, thinks that they went too far. We saw this actually in the opinions, right? The justices are arguing about how we define sex when it comes to discrimination.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely in the dissents, you know, they think that they took sex too far. But as Gorsuch points out, I mean, it, you know, as often with these Supreme Court decisions, it's like two ships passing in the night, where the dissents really focused on the kind of the importance of sexuality and gender identity relative to you know, these particular claims. What Gorsuch and the majority do is they say, but all of these acts, right, ultimately come back to you are either, you know, you're not promoting or you're firing someone because of their sex, you know. And so I think it's, as Gorsuch points out, it's not so much an expansion of the idea of sex, but he's like, but if you just take, you know, this but-for test that is used by the court, you know, but for the fact that this person's gender identity is something you don't agree with, but for the fact that this person's, you know, sexual orientation is something that you don't agree with, you would or would not have hired them. And so I don't think it's so much of an expansion of the idea of what sex is, as opposed to just saying that the act of discrimination is based in a sense of sex.
We're talking with Associate Professor Isaac West, who's walking us through what the implications are at this point, as far as we know, when it comes to Monday's Supreme Court ruling about discrimination on the basis of sex. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What is your response to that ruling protecting lesbian, bisexual, gay, and transgender people from workplace discrimination? How do you think it will change things? Do you think it will change things? And what do you wonder about the broader implications of the decision from the High Court? Give us a call now. Still time for you at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Keely Boltina. We're having this conversation on The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about the ruling from the United States Supreme Court that says employers can't discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. Our guest is Isaac West, who studies legal rhetoric and how gender and sexuality relate to our understanding of our citizenship. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are you an employer or a manager? What actions are you taking to ensure you're complying with Monday's ruling? Are you LGBT? What's it like for you to navigate the system right now? Have you experienced workplace discrimination because you're lesbian, bisexual, gay, or transgender? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Again, we are talking with our guest, who is Isaac West, a professor of communication and gender studies at Vanderbilt University. You mentioned, we've been talking kind of about this idea of firing people. I think that's where we often think of workplace discrimination. But you also mentioned the idea that someone may not be promoted because of this. So how does employment discrimination actually play out?
In any number of ways. And often, you know, the real sad thing here is that it's extremely difficult to prevail in an employment discrimination suit for any number of reasons, right? Because people might have signed arbitration clauses, the costs of litigation, you know, how many people have $10,000 sitting around for a retainer, for an attorney, for example, or what, you know, whatever it might be. It's often difficult to prove the intent or effects, you know, and so there's lots of different ways that discrimination is experienced. And then it's even more difficult to then be able to kind of leverage that evidence or that experience into something that, you know, can then be litigated. And so, you know, it can be all the way from, you know, the vetting process through, you know, a promotion process through a termination process. There's lots of different ways that discrimination can be experienced. And as I said before, you know, the people that are hit hardest by this are the people who are, you know, typically exposed to vulnerability and precarity, you know, throughout society. So in this case, you know, thinking here about how trans folk of color, for example, are really, you know, find it difficult often to find stable employment, you know, and so there are some long-term effects relative to that.
What does this mean in practice, though? I mean, especially in right-to-work states, people can be fired, let go for no reason at all. How can you resolve that in any way with whether you've been fired because of your gender identity or your sexual orientation?
Yeah, and so the decision takes this up in different ways, and there's some kind of crosstalk that happens in the opinions there, but of course, you know, it's almost never the case, right, that you are discriminated against because of just one factor. And so the question has to become, you know, at least according to this case, it's saying that as long as it's a contributing factor, so in other words, that an employer, right, or a set of employees working for a particular company, right, have practiced a discriminatory behavior, right, in this case, the violation of the protection of sex discrimination, that someone can start to bring suit. And so, you know, the hope here is that the explicit protections provided by the Supreme Court decision will deter employers and employees from discriminating. But it is often difficult to kind of parse out, right, these intersectional claims. So whether it's someone's race, their gender, and so on, that are, you know, kind of animating a particular act of discrimination. But nonetheless, if you can prove that at least some of the animus here, right, is because of a perception of your sex. Again, I think it's important to go back to that, the previous question. It's not so much, right, that what is your sex, but it's how people are treating you based upon their perception of your sex or sexuality.
We're talking with Isaac West, who studies legal rhetoric and how gender and sexuality relate to our understanding of citizenship. And there's time for your call at 800-642-1234. What is your response to the Supreme Court's Monday ruling protecting LGBTQ plus people from workplace discrimination? 800-642-1234. Isaac, what civil rights protections had transgender Americans had before this ruling came out?
Few, and even fewer under the Trump administration, who rescinded a bunch of the executive orders, for example, or administrative agency decisions that had helped expand protections for trans folk. before this ruling, you know, most of the protections would have been at like a city level or a state level, such as a local human rights ordinance or maybe a statewide civil rights law, you know, might have protected trans folk. But again, as you know, I kind of said at the beginning, one of the great things about this is really the first explicit declaration by the Supreme Court that trans folks are, you know, entitled to civil rights protection. And so, you know, hopefully they will continue to expand the purview of civil rights protection across a whole host of other things, including housing, medical care, and so on.
You mentioned the Trump administration. This administration has barred most transgender people from serving in the military. What does this ruling mean for government, which is a large employer?
Yes. So the in brief, the military is excluded from Title VII. So that's a whole that's like its whole other kind of thing. But in terms of the government, yeah, I mean, oftentimes, I'm just trying to think the quickest way to answer this, but
I understand.
I think that the agency determinations will matter immensely here, like how they will kind of implement this in the government will be an interesting, I think that will be an interesting development, just given the overall kind of unwillingness to follow some parts of the law. So we'll see how and why this is either followed or not, especially with like within federal government agencies.
Sure, because last week we saw the Federal Department of Health Services remove protections against discrimination for transgender patients in healthcare.
Right.
Does this ruling on sex discrimination have implications for the healthcare sector?
I would think so. I mean, you know, as you know, Gorsuch says, like, you know, this case is just about this case. And I get his point, right, which is to say you're only ruling on the thing that's before you. But I mean, the reason why a Supreme Court takes up a case is to clarify, you know, kind of murky areas of the law. And given the way that, you know, they kind of grant a particular standing and an idea about sex and its importance to not allow animus motivated by sex, one would think that clearly this would give some traction to those who, you know, want to make arguments that, for example, insurance should cover, right, like trans medical care. And it just would seem hard to get beyond that, it seems.
Well, is that true then for things like education or housing discrimination, too?
Again, it just seems so difficult to imagine a way to parse out that sex discrimination is bad in employment discrimination, but it's different in housing and it's different in education, right? And, you know, Alito, I believe, is the one that, you know, goes through and points out all these different places like Title IX, the Fair Housing Act, these different places that use because of sex, and they borrowed the language from Title VII. And so if it's language that's borrowed from this particular statute, one would have to imagine that they're going to understand it similarly across different modes of the law.
We have a quick question from Cindy from Madison as we kind of wrap up our conversation. Cindy says they told their employer about their bisexuality and now the workplace is hostile. Where does Cindy start?
Either through the state agency, and I'm sorry, I didn't look it up beforehand. I should have, but the equal opportunity, you know, employment opportunity, state agency or, federal. I mean, there's lots of different ways to go about it. I would encourage Cindy to look for, to look online, because I think there will definitely be some lawyers who are willing to take up some of these cases now, and maybe, you know, at reduced or, you know, pro bono rates, I think, to kind of enforce these laws. So I would definitely kind of search out your opportunities. But Probably starting with like a local or a state, you know, kind of equal employment opportunity office would be the place to go.
All right, Cindy, we hope that helps. And Isaac, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Isaac West is an associate professor of communication at Vanderbilt University. Isaac's the author of Transforming Citizenships, Transgender Articulations of the Law. Up next is news. Then we have a conversation around police reform that includes the work of police unions. We're hearing from a Wisconsin Police Union representative and from you. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to The Morning Show. Local policymakers, all the way up to national leaders, are trying to figure out the right way to respond to passionate calls for police reform. President Donald Trump signed an executive order urging police departments to improve training and ban chokeholds in certain situations and establish a national database of officers with multiple complaints against them. We're talking about police reform here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. And we're more than 3 weeks into national demonstrations after George Floyd's death. Video shows a white Minneapolis police officer kneeling on his neck for minutes, and an autopsy confirms it killed Floyd. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the head of Wisconsin's largest law enforcement union? What do you want to know about how it works with police officers and departments? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Certainly. The public is calling for change. People are dying at the hands of police. Race plays a role. What are the transformative ways that police can change these outcomes?
Well, I think, you know, in large part, if we have to begin by having an informed conversation, a public discourse about what's going on with law enforcement generally throughout the country, and also at the same time, what's going on with the law enforcement community here in Wisconsin? Because I think there are some notable distinctions. You know, a lot of the reforms that have been discussed thus far are already very well established in Wisconsin. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have room to grow. We certainly do. And I think the law enforcement profession is one that's unique in that way, that it is always looking to improve and build upon its strengths. So, you know, we're doing our part to talk about, you know, the issues of law enforcement and its relationship with, you know, communities of color in particular. But we also need to have a broader public discourse about, you know, systemic bias in our country and in our state.
How do we begin those conversations, though?
Well, I think, you know, things like this help. I mean, like many people throughout the nation, officers in Wisconsin, you know, saw the horrific video demonstrating the gross mistreatment of George Floyd at the hands of the officers in Minneapolis. And, you know, for our part, we had to start by coming out, like many people did, and expressing, you know, that the point that was not representative of the law enforcement community here in Wisconsin. You know, that with regard to the chokeholds and, you know, the kneeling on the neck of George Floyd and the abuse that we all witnessed him suffering, you know, those are techniques that are not even taught here in Wisconsin. And so I think it's important to talk about, you know, where law enforcement in our state in particular has demonstrated some strengths and how we can build upon those strengths. And at the same time, be responsive and sensitive to those who, you know, saw the George Floyd video. And while it's not representative of the law enforcement community in this state, in our opinion, we also at the same time recognize that, you know, that is an experience that is shared and by many Americans of color and throughout the country. And we have to be responsive to that. And we have to, you know, try and move this public dialogue forward.
You mentioned that those are specific maneuvers not taught in Wisconsin, but are they used by Wisconsin law enforcement officers?
I'm not aware that they are. They are not taught as part of the law enforcement curriculum in this state, and that's been the case for many years. It's also true at the same time that they're not prohibited. They are specifically in the law enforcement curriculum. Officers are instructed not to do those things, but they aren't prohibited under the law. And so that's why we've come out and said, you know, that banning chokeholds and things of that nature make perfect sense for us. We don't have any problem with that. I have never encountered in all the years I've been working for our association, I've never encountered a situation in which that maneuver has been used.
Yeah, I mean, NPR reports that chokeholds have been banned in the New York police for almost 30 years, and yet there are still hundreds of complaints a year about their use. So, and you publicly said we support a chokehold ban. How do you see that chokehold ban being enforced and holding officers who use it accountable?
Well, I think, you know, in this day and age, as more and more agencies, begin to institute body-worn camera programs, which is a practice that we have largely supported for several years, which also stands in stark contrast to some of the positions, exemplified by other police unions around the country. People have cell phones and people have cameras. And, you know, I think every law enforcement officer ought to know, if they don't already, that, you know, chances are whatever action they take in any given case is likely to be recorded. And so if officers utilize holds that are either outlawed or prohibited, they need to be held accountable. And our organization has long stood for that proposition. We've lobbied the legislature to add accountability within the law enforcement profession and to add transparency as well. And so we think this is a continuation of that effort.
Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, and we're talking with him about calls for police reform and what that looks like in Wisconsin. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the leader of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association? Do you support the idea of defunding police, moving some money that goes to police departments now to other services? What response do you want to see from police forces at this time? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You're also welcome to email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jim, you just mentioned body cams. Calls for body cameras gained steam in Wisconsin after officers killed black men in 2013 and 2014, and yet we still see deaths at the hands of police officers. What role has body camera footage played when we've seen those officer-involved shootings in our state?
Well, body camera footage, in every single case that I've worked, and I've represented, and we represent, in fact, as an organization, the vast majority of officers that are involved in officer-involved shootings, for instance. In every case in which body camera evidence has been present, it has been helpful in terms of providing some a clear picture of what transpired, and it can help determine, you know, whether or not the officer was justified in taking the action that he or she did. And it really, you know, body camera evidence in particular, it provides the communities that are impacted by these, you know, devastating events, these tragic events, because every officer involved death is tragic, regardless of the circumstances. But as it relates to, you know, a determination as to whether or not an officer acted appropriately, the circumstances matter. And so the body camera video can provide a sense of resolution to a community that has every right to demand answers.
When we're talking about use of force, 2 weeks ago on this program, we spoke with State Representative Chris Taylor, who says we need a model use of force policy for law enforcement agencies. It would guide officers on how to deal with members of the public, for instance, if they're having mental health crises or addiction, for example. Do you support that idea?
We do. And I think it's, you know, important to note that, you know, the State Department of Justice does have a model law enforcement policy. And so that does already exist. In fact, you know, there's been a lot of discussion, I think legitimate discussion, about Chris Taylor's legislation, Assembly Bill 1012, which would require that certain principles being incorporated into every use of force policy in the state. And I think that's a legitimate discussion from a public policy perspective. I think it's also important to recognize that all of those principles are already well established in Wisconsin, whether some in state statute, some in the administrative code, and some in the law enforcement curriculum that governs training in this state. I think, again, whether or not we should codify those things into a single statute, we're not opposed to that by any means.
So if that's the case, that all of these policies exist somewhere in Wisconsin, are those policies enough?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think, you have a lot of agencies in communities around the state that are taking a closer look at their policies and to make sure that they're reflective of the, the goals of the, each agency and that they're, sensitive to the times in which we live. And I think that's a healthy, regular practice in which, to engage in. And I think the policies in Wisconsin are good. Again, that doesn't mean that we can't improve upon them. I think Wisconsin has led the way and I think is very progressive when compared to agencies and law enforcement communities around the country. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't constantly reevaluate how law enforcement does its job.
What about the issue of qualified immunity? That's a shield for police officers so they can't be sued. And yet we see doctors can be sued, reporters can be sued, rideshare drivers. We assume that all of these people can do their jobs at a high standard and still be held accountable if they don't do them right. Why are police different?
Well, because I think, law enforcement is obviously a job where officers are expected to make life, split second decisions, life and death decisions. And if they're done in the course of their service and they haven't broken any law or violated any policy, it's well established that they should be, have some protection. They should be insulated to some extent. I think restricting that or peeling that back is could be very dangerous to the law enforcement community. And I don't know there's been some scholarship recently that, simply repealing qualified immunity in and of itself wouldn't change anything because many states, such as in Wisconsin's one of them, have indemnification statutes, which still require that, an employer to indemnify or basically represent officers that are sued for things done in the course of their employment.
We're talking with Jim Palmer, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. And we're talking with him about what police reform might look like, what the state of policing is in Wisconsin now, especially as demonstrations have swept across the country, including here in Wisconsin. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for him? What do you want to know about how his organization works for and with police officers and what role the community has in that? What do you want to say about your relationships with officers in your community? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Protesters demonstrating against police brutality want to see changes in law enforcement. Among their demands, defund police. Some say take away all public dollars. Others argue for taking a portion of money that goes to police departments and shifting those resources to areas like education and mental health resources. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about it with Jim Palmer, who's executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. The number again, 800-642-1234. And Jim, yesterday, the Milwaukee Common Council approved modeling for a 10% cut in the city's budget for police. In Milwaukee, about one in every $10 of local government spending goes to the police. What are your thoughts on the idea of defunding police in part or in whole?
Well, and I think it's important to note just as a prefatory matter that it seems that, the notion of defunding the police means different things to different people and to different groups. And, as law enforcement doesn't like to be painted with a broad brush, I try to avoid, doing the same with regard to our critics. If we're talking about imposing significant reductions in police spending, I think the defund movement is, you know, counterproductive on multiple levels. As you may know, and as others, as some of your listeners may know, our organization has been annually commissioning a statewide poll through the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute on a wide variety of issues related to policing and criminal justice for the last 8 years. And in fact, we're the only law enforcement group in the country that does engages in an effort like this. We've consistently posed a number of questions that relate to this issue. And, you know, what we found, for example, in 2019, the last year for which we have complete results currently, the vast majority of respondents indicated that they, you know, agreed that having a well-funded police department contributes to the quality of life in their community. And that's been consistent over the years that we've asked that question. And we've also asked people, you know, whether they want more more officers in their neighborhoods, less officers, or whether they think that number should stay the same. And the majority of the respondents in our poll have indicated they want more officers, not less. And that's especially true for minority respondents. And then lastly, we also asked questions, for example, about community-oriented policing, that is, having officers in their neighborhoods that work to develop and foster relationships with the people they serve. And a larger proportion of minority respondents have consistently indicated very strong support for this kind of policing. You know, so I mention these issues within this context because, you know, imposing significant reductions on police spending would seem to compromise some of the law enforcement services and strategies that communities of color in particular value the most. So, you know, we have some serious concerns about, you know, what that means for police departments, what that means for our law enforcement's relationship with the communities they serve, and what it means for officer safety and public safety.
Earlier this week, we had a professor on who's an historian, has written books about police and how all of that works together. And we were talking about the idea, though, that he says the things that we ask of our police departments are extensive, and police aren't trained for all of those things. They might not be the right people to respond to all of those things all the time. So part of the idea of defunding police would be to say our law enforcement officers are not the best people to respond here. Let's bring in the mental health professional. So instead of putting that money into the police, we should put it into mental health professionals. Would you support that kind of shift to try to better serve those communities?
I think law enforcement has long felt that, you know, more and more responsibility is put on the backs of officers in our state to respond to situations that for which they haven't been provided enough support, whether it's resources or training or what have you. So I think, you know, our position is that we would absolutely agree with, greater investments in social services and health services, and mental health services in particular. But, you know, it's a false dilemma, I think, to say that, you know, we should just simply, you know, make a significant reduction to a police agency and put it in this other area. I think we really need to have a detailed plan, and that I have not necessarily seen. It's our view that this really is something that requires some precise policymaking calibration that we just haven't seen. I'm not aware of, you know, a cadre of social workers that is, you know, that stands at the ready to, you know, fill the gaps that we have left unfilled for so long in our state and in our country. So we would support greater investments in those areas, but we think it needs to be thoughtful in a way that we just haven't seen as of yet. Now, there are a number of communities that are exploring that, and I hope that they begin to have those in-depth discussions.
We're talking with Jim Palmer, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. You're listening to The Morning Show, and Chris from Appleton wants to join the conversation. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
So I might be mistaken, but I thought in Wisconsin that teachers had their collective bargaining rights taken, so no union. So I'm wondering why police are allowed to have a union.
All right. Thanks for the question, Chris. And I think you're referring to Act 10, which did reduce collective bargaining rights for a lot of state and municipal employees, including K-12 teachers. Actually, this week, two conservative researchers from Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty argue in favor of extending Act 10 to police unions. with the goal of limiting union power and disciplinary measures. So that's on people's minds, Chris. What are your thoughts on that proposal, Jim? Act 10 for police.
Well, you know, it's true. The collective bargaining rights of many public employees in Wisconsin were severely curtailed in 2011. And our organization, you know, stood with teachers and stood with other public employees in opposing those measures. You know, I think some of the discussion about curtailing police union influence or the ability of police unions to, you know, negotiate and represent their members is based on, you know, some misconceptions that simply don't apply to the situation here in Wisconsin. For instance, there's been, you know, some discussion about in Minneapolis, for instance, that, you know, there are provisions in there. The contract for those officers that provides for the destruction of certain personnel records that insulates and shields officers from having to cooperate with investigations into their conduct. Those are things that simply are not present in Wisconsin. And I think it's a misnomer to suggest that, you know, because of the things that, you know, we've seen in other states that, you know, we should, again, paint law enforcement in Wisconsin with a broad brush that simply it doesn't fit. Here in our state, as a, you know, the largest law enforcement group, you know, we have worked for greater accountability. We've worked for greater transparency, and not only in how officers' conduct is investigated, but in you know, the hiring and firing of officers in Wisconsin. So it's not our role, and I think this is a misconception that is held in some parts that to protect bad apples. Because nobody wants a bad officer out of the profession more than a good one. And, you know, we view our role as, you know, there are times when officers, it becomes clear that they should not be in the profession. And we don't benefit in any shape, way, or form. And the profession doesn't benefit by keeping officers that aren't up to the task in the job.
We're quickly running out of time, but I do wonder, when you think of the future of policing, how is it different than what we see today?
Well, I hope what we're seeing now, I hope, you know, I think we're at a turning point, clearly. And I hope we can begin to have an open and honest public dialogue. And we really need to kind of break out of our silos. And I'm saying this as much about our organization as, you know, about anyone else. I mean, our, you know, group is an interest group like others, and we know we operate within a narrow set of interests involving criminal justice and policing and labor issues specific to law enforcement. But it's clear that the problem of racial bias in our country and our state is systemic, and so I think for us, you know, as an organization, we're going to have to get more involved in educational policy and health policy and economic policy, because it's clear that all these things are interconnected, and we really need to have a broad-based discussion is focused on a systemic set of solutions.
All right. Hopefully we're starting that now. Jim Palmer, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, and we've been talking about what police reform looks like as we see calls for it across the country and here in Wisconsin. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.